So the Dhamma for today is called the Sapurisa Dhamma. Sapurisa is a fairly generic word meaning something like a good person. But it has the connotation of being a cultured person or a high-minded individual. Someone worthy of respect. Someone wise. These are sort of the connotations, the implication of calling someone a Sapurisa. Literally, it just means good person, good Purisa person. But the Buddha used this word to refer to those who should be listened to, those who whose Dhamma should be followed, the Dhamma that are worth learning, worth following. So these are the Dhamma that make someone worth listening to and worth following. So we can take it in two ways. First of all, of course, it's the sort of person we want to associate with, the sort of person we want to follow, listen to, emulate. But the second, of course, is the sort of person we want to be ourselves. Obviously, it behooves us to become Sapurisa as well. So these aren't very specific meditative teachings, but they're more descriptive of the sort of person you become as a result of practicing the Buddha's teaching, as a result of practicing good teachings. This is the sort of person you become. And more generally, it's the sort of person worth listening to or worth following, a wise person in the world. So in other religions, in other spiritual traditions or in secular traditions, there might be different opinions about what makes someone a person worth following or listening to, a cultured individual, which we may agree or disagree with, but this is according to Buddhism, according to the Buddha, what are the really important qualities that we should cultivate to be a good person or a person worthy of respect. So the seven Sapurisa Dhamma are Dhammanyutta, knowledge of the Dhamma, Attanyutta, knowledge of the meaning, Attanyutta, knowledge of oneself, Matanyutta, knowledge of measure, Kalanyutta, knowledge of time, Parisanyutta, knowledge of company, and Pugalanyutta, knowledge of persons or people. These are the seven Sapurisa Dhamma, the Dhamma that the Buddha said make someone a good person or a person worthy of respect. So the first couple are pretty obvious. Dhammanyutta, obviously, in Buddhism, we couldn't consider someone to be worth listening to if they didn't know the Dhamma. The Dhamma meaning at the simplest level, meaning the truth. More specifically, the truth taught by the Buddha. So not all truth. Some truth is not very important, not very meaningful, and if a person is knowledgeable in certain areas, then still not considered to be of any value or any merit. Doesn't make one worthy of respect in the Buddha's teaching to know a lot about mathematics or biology or chemistry or the arts or that sort of thing. But things that are of importance are knowledge of sila, knowledge of samadhi, knowledge of panya, wisdom, knowledge of mindfulness, the four satipatthana, knowledge of all the bodhipakkhya dhamma, the 37 constituents of enlightenment. All the many teachings of the Buddha, any of the teachings of the Buddha are worth learning. So it's the sort of person that we want to associate with, obviously someone who knows the Buddha's teaching. At the very basics level, someone who has the intellectual knowledge, someone who is able to answer our questions, who is able to refer to the Buddha's teaching and provide us with the information that we need to apply ourselves to the practice properly. Someone who has correct knowledge, who doesn't get the Buddha's teaching wrong, who enumerates it correctly and is able to provide the teachings this is the sort of person that obviously we want to pay attention to, and it's the sort of person we want to be as well. We want to be someone who is knowledgeable of the Dhamma, so if other people ask us, we can tell them, so that we ourselves have this information at our fingertips, that we're able to access the Buddha's teaching. We have to be knowledgeable of the Dhamma. So on a basic level, it just means intellectual knowledge. Obviously, on a deeper level, it means actually knowing these teachings for ourselves, having experienced them, having experienced suffering at the basic level. No, the first thing for us to experience is suffering, and to understand is suffering. Not exactly experience in the way we would speak of it, but to become familiar with suffering in a way that most people normally aren't. Though a person might experience great suffering in their lives, they're not really very familiar with it if they haven't spent time being mindful of it. So just knowledge of suffering on a deeper level, it actually means understanding it and understanding the cause of suffering, understanding the three characteristics, that all things that arise are impermanent. Not just knowing that intellectually, but knowing that truth, having experienced it for oneself. All the way until we ultimately experience Nibbana, the freedom from suffering. This would be Dhammanyutta at the highest level. Someone who knows the Dhamma means someone who has seen the Lokuttara Dhamma, the super mundane Dhamma, for themselves. Is the sort of person obviously we want to be, obviously the sort of person we want to associate with. Someone who has seen Nibbana, experienced Nibbana for themselves, is someone worth listening to. They know the path, they know the destination, they can tell you how they got there. At the very least, they can provide some hint for you to get there as well. As opposed to someone who hasn't been there and can't accurately or verifiably point out the path. Attanyutta, as opposed to Dhammanyutta, means the meaning of the Dhamma. So you can contrast this with knowing, for example, what are the four Satipatthana, knowing what are the four Arya Satcha, even the Sapurisa Dhamma that we're talking about today. If you know what these seven are, as with all the Buddhist teaching, it's equally important that we understand what they mean. So what is the meaning of each of the Dhammas of the Buddha? What is the meaning of Satipatthana? What is the meaning of Vipassana? What is the meaning of the First Noble Truth? So if we know that the First Noble Truth is that there is suffering, but we can't explain because we don't understand what that actually means, we might say something like life is suffering, or we might say something that when you feel pain, that's suffering, and if you are able to avoid the pain, then you're free from suffering. And we say, freedom from suffering comes from giving up or escaping from physical suffering, for example. Not understanding that the truth of suffering is something to be fully understood for ourselves. So the meaning of the Dhamma is very important. It's easy to misunderstand what is the Buddha's teaching. If you think, suffering is something we should run away from, we should try to fix if there is suffering. That's not how the Buddha taught. The Buddha said there is suffering, but he said that we should understand fully, completely understand suffering, so we face suffering. And we understand that things aren't actually causing us suffering. Our suffering is because we don't understand them, because we aren't familiar with them, and so we react. We judge them as bad, as a problem. And we judge other things as good and as worth clinging to, and so on. So this, for example, Attanyutta means knowing the meaning of the Dhamma. Not only should be able to recite the Buddha's teachings by memory, but we should also be able to understand them. And this of course, on a deeper level, relates to our practice and our realization for ourselves. Only through personal realization can you really say you understand the meaning of the Dhamma or the truth of the Buddha's teaching. The third, Attanyutta, means knowledge of oneself, which of course doesn't mean knowledge of the self. It doesn't relate to knowing or becoming in touch with your inner soul or self. It's not about that kind of thing. It's a very simple, more colloquial and figure of speech. To say that we should know ourselves. This means we should know the measure of ourselves. What are our qualities? We should know the bad characteristics and the good characteristics. What defilements do we have? We should know our greed and be aware of when we have greed, and aware of the anger that we have inside, our potential to give rise to anger. We should be aware of our delusion. To know these things is a very valuable thing. The Buddha referred to it as buried treasure. That's very hard for us to find. And if we do find it, it's such a real valuable thing to dig up, to unearth. So much about ourselves is hidden, and all of it is of great value if we can dig it up and come to see it for ourselves, bring it into the light. Attanyuta means knowing these things, the things that we normally ignore or are ignorant about ourselves, not realizing that we're causing ourselves suffering. The biggest thing that we don't realize is that we are the greatest cause of suffering for ourselves. Other people cannot really hurt us. External influences can only trigger the mind. But it's actually our mind, our own qualities that cause us to experience happiness or suffering. And it's through ignorance of them that we cultivate bad habits, through lack of clarity and lack of understanding about the nature of how our mind works. We really don't have very much depth of understanding of how our own mind works, and as a result we make so many mistakes. Wanting to be happy, we engage in activities that lead to suffering. Wanting to be free from suffering, we engage in those very activities that cause us suffering. We have no real understanding of how to bring about happiness because we don't understand ourselves. We don't understand how we work. We don't realize that we are acting and speaking and even thinking with qualities that are causing us suffering, with greed, with anger, with delusion. So we know our negative aspects, we know our positive qualities as well. Knowledge of our level of ethics and our restraint of mind and our capacity to guard our senses and that sort of thing. Our focus, we have a sense of our level of focus and concentration and our wisdom. Having a sense of our good qualities allows us to measure them and understand the work we have left to do. Understanding the limits to our mental qualities as opposed to overestimating ourselves. It's a common thing for intensive meditators to overestimate the benefits of the practice, and when they leave, when they continue on with their lives, they're discouraged, thinking that they wasted their time, as they thought they got they gained such and such a level of attainment, and then realizing later that their attainment was on a lesser level. So knowing yourself and having some kind of clarity of understanding, as opposed to wishing or wishful thinking, and thinking you are enlightened when you're thinking you've reached a goal when you haven't actually reached it, or thinking you're at a certain level when you're not at that certain level. Of course, mindfulness is a big part of this. Knowing oneself is a description of what it means to be mindful. A mindful person is someone who is in touch with their own mind, how the mind works, seeing the good and the bad, and having a good sense of the nature of their mind and how the mind works. This is a quality that we want in those who we list, those who we follow, and it's a quality, of course, that we seek out for ourselves, knowledge of ourselves. A person who doesn't know themselves obviously can't provide much help for other people, but more importantly, isn't much help to themselves. Not having knowledge of yourself, of how your mind works, is a major, sort of the major cause of stress and suffering, as we make mistakes and engage in harmful behavior of body, speech, and mind. Number four, Mattanyutta, knowledge of measure, which means something like knowledge of the right amount. And this most often refers to the very simple act of partaking of food. And the Buddha was very insistent on reminding us of the importance of moderation in eating. And it might seem that, well, that's just one of the many things that one could find seek moderation. And it's true, there are other dhammas, other things that we can and should exercise moderation in regards to. But there's nothing like food as it relates to our mental health in terms of what we partake, because food is something that we have to partake of every day, and it's something that is very fundamental in what it means to be alive, what it means to be a corporeal being. You know, food is what nourishes and what sustains us, it's what allows us to live. And more importantly, it's what we chase after in so many different ways. We chase after it in a very practical sense just to keep ourselves alive. We're constantly having to seek out food. Even monks have to do this. But it's also something that we seek out for pleasure. It's one of the major sources of sensual pleasure for human beings. We seek out pleasant tastes and sensations in eating, almost more than any other thing. There are very few other things that are on par with the level of sensual pleasure that we acquire and that we seek out in comparison to food. So it's obviously something that is prone to major abuse. It's the sort of thing that is a cause for great suffering as we abuse it, for those we don't know moderation, where we don't know the right measure. And more directly, where we don't exercise mindfulness in our consumption of food. So to be accurate, moderation in eating isn't really about having some scientific means of knowing how much you should eat. It's much more about being mindful. And as with all of these dhammas, really mindfulness is obviously at the core. It's at the core of all of our development as individuals. But here especially we can see that rather than trying to seek out moderation, it's something that we can see in ourselves and in others as being a result of the proper cultivation of mindfulness. If we cultivate mindfulness successfully, if we're systematic, if we're diligent in our cultivation of mindfulness, we'll become the sort of person who knows the right amount to everything, especially or most glaringly in regards to food. A person who is mindful obviously will only eat as much food as they need to eat. Furthermore, they'll be so in tune with their body, attanyu, they'll know themselves, even on a physical level, that they'll know how much is enough. And they'll become very quickly familiar with how much food and how to recognize the signs of how much is enough food rather than going over it. You see, this how we fail so much in ordinary life in this regard by overeating or consuming foods that are delicious as opposed to nutritious. So we suffer as a result. We'll find that we have great stomach pains and heartburn and all kinds of sicknesses that arise as a result of not really being conscious of our behavior during eating, conscious of the mental behavior of grasping at pleasant sensations, pleasant tastes, and so on. So matanyu is not something that should be known intellectually, how much is the right amount, but it's a sign of a sapurisa. A sign of a good person is that they do have a keen and innate sense of the right amount. So food is the best example. Of course, there are other things, as I said. There's knowing the right amount to sleep, not sleeping too much, for example. Knowing the right amount for speech. The Buddha was critical of people who didn't speak at all, who spent their life, monks who took a vow of silence. He said, that makes you no better than an animal. I mean, considering it's important to speak sometimes, there is speech that is important, not much, but some. And on the other hand, for the most part, beings and even meditators will find themselves speaking too much. Speech is something that should be limited very drastically. A person who's undertaking and who's dedicated to the practice of meditation and set on attaining benefit through the practice of meditation should drastically limit the amount of speech that they engage in, engaging only when it is absolutely necessary to speak. You know, there were monks in the time of the Buddha who only would speak once every 5 days. Even though they lived together, they would use hand gestures instead of speaking, trying to be restrained and vigilant in their pursuit of mindfulness and their pursuit of Buddha's teaching. So knowing this sort of measure, knowing the amount for these various things, work, for example, we should work and we have to work, and as a part of keeping the monastery going, everyone has to chip in. But someone who could spend all of their day just in physical labor, sweeping, for example, and none of that is of any deep value on a spiritual level. It can be a real distraction, in fact, from the practice. So knowing the right amount, even knowing the right amount of practice, the right amount of walking, the right amount of sitting. And we set limits on our walking and limits on our sitting, and we take a break between each round. Because you can push yourself with formal practice too hard. Of course, you can't push yourself too hard with mindfulness. But the great thing is that mindfulness doesn't have to be undertaken formally. Taking a break in between practice doesn't mean taking a break and being mindful. You can be mindful sitting, you can be mindful standing, you can be mindful walking, you can be mindful lying down, and should be. In all of these postures, mindful as best you can. So matanyuta means many ways knowing the right amount to things, and it obviously comes from being present, being conscious of the nature of your activities and your experiences, and knowing what being seeing for yourself when you've passed a limit, you've crossed a line, and should stop or should change your activity. The fifth is kalanyutta, knowledge of time. So on a conventional level, this means knowledge of various times, knowledge of when you have to come for reporting, knowledge of the time in meditation, when is the right time to meditate, knowledge of the time to eat. For meditators and monks, we can only eat during the morning hours, and knowledge of the time to go on alms round. We can't go on alms round if it's not dawn yet. We have to wait till dawn to go. These sorts of things, various kinds of time. It's a sign of a good person that they're on time, that they're not late for anything, that they're not overly early, that they're aware of the time. Someone can miss an appointment or can be late for an appointment for various reasons, but if a person is unmindful and as a result just doesn't have a sense of the right time, it's a good sign that they're probably not paying close attention and they're not really conscious of their reality. Conventionally, it's not really a perfect sign. I mean, obviously, someone can lose track of time and still you still might consider that there was something else that their mind was focused on, right? So a person can be practicing meditation and can enter into jhana or something like that and perhaps miss some sort of appointment. But generally speaking, if a person is always late, if a person is missing appointments and that sort of thing, it's not a good sign. On a deeper level, however, kalanyuta it probably relates to being on time and so on, means knowledge of the present moment and being able to differentiate the present moment from the past and the future. There are three times in Buddhism, and really much more to the point than talking about being on time for appointments is knowledge of the three times. This is a very core aspect of the Buddha's teaching. A person who is caught up in the past clearly doesn't have a good understanding of the limits of the past, that the past doesn't really exist. You're not actually living in the past, you're living in the present, in a state of mind in the present that is remembering things that happened in the past, or giving rise, more accurately, not even remembering, giving rise to sights and sounds and mental activity that is a reflection of what happened in the past, or an echo of what happened in the past. It's still happening in the present. And mostly we don't experience this, we aren't conscious of this. We think we're in the past, we're living in the past, in that moment. And the same with the future, thinking about what we will do, planning, imagining, fantasizing, having all these dreams about the future. This is not being present, not being mindful. The practice of mindfulness, you see that even future thought, past thought, any kind of thought, whether it's present, past, or future, is always happening in the present. So when we live in the future, all these worries and ambitions and goals we have, all of that's happening here and now. But the problem is that we're not conscious of that. We're not present with it. We're not aware and alert and in tune or in touch with the activity that's going on while we plan about the future or mourn about the past or are nostalgic about the past or that sort of thing. So as a result of being caught up in these times that don't really exist, we are vulnerable to all sorts of bad habits, the cultivation of greed, of anger, of delusion, worry, fear, all of these things that we know come from living in the past, living in the future. People have PTSD, are triggered again and again, and are unable to move past the events that they've gone through. Through the practice of mindfulness, we can see the difference. We can come to see this truth, that past thinking, future thinking is still just present thinking. That the only reality that truly exists is the present moment. And this works really well and is very important for dealing with so-called problems, what we would perceive as problems in our lives. Because a problem can only exist with the help of the past and the future. Something in the present moment can never be a problem, it can only be an experience, it's momentary. So if we live in the present, we actually have no real problems. We only have moments of experience. And a moment of experience is the most trivial, easy thing to deal with. If that's where our mind is focused, if that's what we're experiencing, if we have a clear awareness of that as being the reality of life, the reality of our experience, then we free ourselves from all sorts of suffering and stress that comes from problems, that comes from perceiving things as problems, as something that has happened in the past or something that is looming in the future. And none of these things are truly real. And as a result, they truly cannot hurt us if we don't give them power. By placing our attention in the present, by being able to distinguish between the present and the present reality and the future and past unreality, we are safe. We are completely safe and secure, free from the dangers of the defilements which can't arise if we're focused on just experiences. So kalanyuta on a deeper level means this knowledge of the present moment. The sixth is parisanyuta. Parisanyuta means knowledge of the different kinds of companies, different kinds of groups or communities. So this is a sort of strictly conventional teaching relating to how someone is able to interact with various types of communities. Because our behavior and our attitude and our approach to different types of people has to be to some extent different. Or maybe to put it another way, our interactions, our ability to interact with different types of people depends on our ability to adapt, our ability to adapt to their different mannerisms. To some extent, a person who is wise, a person who is a satpurisa, doesn't change no matter what community or company or culture they're engaged in. Now, they're able to adapt, certainly, but they're also able to respond without being flustered, without being disturbed, without being triggered or upset by different cultures and different mannerisms. An ordinary individual might feel social anxiety in different communities when around rich people or poor people or people of different ethnicity, when around people of different religious or cultural background, when around people of a different gender even, people of a different age, when around old people, when around young people, all of the different kinds of people. It's a sign that the Buddha pointed to that a person is undeveloped, if they're disturbed, if they're unable to adapt, inflexible, and unable to enter with confidence in the different kinds of communities or amongst different company. So a sign of someone who is developed, who is a good person, is that they see through people. They see through the different kinds of people, or the different groups of people, and seeing that behind them there is only still people. There is still only the body and the mind. So a person who practices the focused on the truth and seeing the truth of reality sees beings as simply this, physical and mental experiences that arise and cease, because they're familiar with how their mind works, how the mind works. They're familiar with the truth of experience and the truth of reality. They don't place any weight or importance on the differences in regards to the various types of people. And so as a result, they are at peace and calm and unshaken when having to engage with different sorts of people. There is no one who takes them off guard, whether it's someone who is loud and obnoxious or someone who is quiet and peaceful. They're equally able to approach such people and engage without fear or without stress or without agitation. It's a sign that you can see in people who are cultured or developed that they are undisturbed and easily able to adapt to different types of people. Something that the Buddha had very clearly, was able to approach kings and be approached by kings, and likewise to be able to engage with poor beggars and people who were impoverished, or those who were sick or old, or those who were young. The Buddha could approach all of these people without fear, without uncertainty, and was able to teach the same Dhamma to all of them in a manner that they would be able to understand. Parisanyuta. This final one, Pugalanyuta. Pugalanyuta is one of the most important conventional dhammas. It's not a deep teaching on how to understand reality. Pugala is not something that relates to ultimate reality. In ultimate reality, there is no pugala, there is no person, there are no people. But in a conventional sense, this is the most important, because it's the essence of what we're talking about today, how we determine the sort of person we want to be and the sort of person we want to associate with. Pugalanyuta means knowing the sort of person that we want to associate with and the sort of person that we want to be. Being able to differentiate, see that these sorts of people should be avoided, or at the very least should be instructed and guided. And these sorts of people should be learned from. Some sort of people should be followed and emulated. And some sort of person you want to associate with, some sort of person you feel would be better off to not associate with, that no good comes from spending time or being close to such a person. Purisanyuta is, Pugalanyuta is the essence of the beginning of the religious life. It's where we all start, finding someone or someone's groups of people or people who we can approach and who we can rely upon to instruct and to guide and to support us in our practice of the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha said this is the essence of the holy life, it's the entirety of it, that we should find people who can guide us and who can support us and who we can emulate. So it's crucial that we're able to distinguish, and it's an enviable trait, something that most of us don't have when we first start out, not knowing which sort of person to follow, which sort of person to listen to, and what sort of person not to listen to and not to follow. Something that we can envy in those who have it and respect, and hopefully emulate. Something that we can take from those who are wise, the people that they respect, the people that they say good about, we should. We know that we can then approach such people, when we have people who can tell us who are good people and who are bad people, then we have a way to, we can learn for ourselves good from bad. Obviously, through our practice of mindfulness, this comes as well, and as a result of mindfulness, we're able to be better in tune with the nature of individuals, seeing when someone is consumed by anger, consumed by greed, consumed by delusion, and knowing not to engage or rely on such a person. At the very least, or at the very best, we can help them. But there's no way that we can rely on someone who is consumed by defilement. And so, knowing this and being in tune with reality, in tune with our experience, so that we can catch when others are being greedy or anger or deluded, is incredibly valuable. And the opposite is, of course, incredibly valuable, to see someone when someone's mind is pure, and to recognize that and to incline towards associating with such people. This is of great value. So all seven of these considered to be good dhammas, good things to consider. Of course, it's a conventional teaching about a person. It's not on a deep level in terms of experience of ultimate realities. But again, as I've said, many of them relate to our practice and are very much the sorts of qualities that come from the practice. And so on a conventional level, these are the sort of things that point to people that we can rely upon, people that we can learn from, listen to, and also the sort of person that we want to be. We can have a sense of the direction that we're headed in or that we want to head in based on these sorts of dhammas. So a valuable teaching, something that we hear about quite often as being one of the cornerstones of the Buddha's teaching, the Sat Purisa Dhamma. So that's the Dhamma for today.